as we start with Romans lesson 4, my guess is, because I'm overwhelmed with the theology of Romans 3, and continue, I would imagine you are too. Yes?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so this has concerned me because I've known all along, okay, this theology is heavy, deep, and unfamiliar to us. The problem is we all know the terms, right? We've heard about righteousness. We've heard about justification. We've heard about propitiation. And all those words, we kind of go, oh, yeah. And we have no clue. It makes no sense. It's not our normal day language. We don't use that. We use it in some ways, usually in the negative way. Oh, you're doing that. You're justifying your, that kind of thing. So I decide, it wasn't really me to decide. God just brought this story to me. I thought, you know, we need to tell a story. Mm-hmm. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell a story. I'm going to have you participate in the story before we get into the text. So that when we get into the text, maybe you have a different idea of what Paul is talking about. I will explain the text as we go. But even if we don't get through the full text, I think the story helps illustrate what Paul is trying to tell us. I hope. That is my prayer. All the time that you were in group, all I spent is praying, Lord, you've got to pull this through me because it is tough. I'm not going to lie. It's tough, and it's tough for me, and it has been tough for me. And it's important, though, that we understand, and it's important that we know the fullness of the gospel. And we'll talk about why that's important as we get into the text part. So I'm going to tell you a story about there was a town. There was a town that all the people living in the town were emaciated. So imagine a town with people walking around emaciated. I'm thinking, I don't watch this show, but I know that this is in my head what it looks like, Walking Dead, mm-hmm. right? So people are just, you know, walking around like this. But it's not because they don't have food. It's actually because they eat the wrong food. And the food that they eat is all sugar. So we know that in human beings, thus all the sugar sitting around, we know in human beings that a baby actually will actually choose to eat the right foods and the right amounts of foods until the point where refined sugar is introduced into their diet. And then all of a sudden, all of that innate understanding of what to eat mm-hmm. goes out the door. Mm-hmm. Wow. That's just how our body works. Our body knows what it needs until refined sugar is actually introduced. So we have this town, then, that not only has refined sugar been introduced into their diet, it's their diet. That's all they eat is refined sugar. And so in this town, they don't cook for themselves. It's a town full of restaurants. And the restaurants all serve refined sugar. That's all they serve. And so there are proprietors of these restaurants. And so, Cindy, you're going to be the proprietor of the Reese's restaurant. And as Cindy takes ownership of this restaurant, she's going to see who wants to eat at her restaurant. And the cost of eating at her restaurant to get a Reese's peanut butter cup is, it says, you can get 2 cups for 5 days of thought.
5 days of
thought.
Thought.
So for you to give over your thinking to her.
Oh.
So she can control your thinking.
Goodness.
So she's going to be the proprietor of Reese's. Now the problem is, every one of you needs, we've already eaten breakfast hopefully, every one of you needs at least 2 meals today. This is all that's available. So you've got to choose one of those. You have no other place to choose. Alex, you are going to be the proprietor of Payday Your Lucky Day restaurant. Payday Your Lucky Day says you can get 3 of them for 2 days of use of your body. So you can either trade for 5 days of thought of your thinking to Cindy, or 2 days of Alex using your body, for however she wants to use it. The third proprietor is Kitty Kitty Kit Kat Restaurant. Anna, you're going to be the proprietor of that. Anna's restaurant says, if you buy one, you're going to feel great. In other words, give you her emotions. If you buy 2, you feel better. So, here's the jobs. They're going to be asking, what do you want to eat today for your meals? You have to choose at least two meals, knowing that you're giving either your thought, your thinking, your bodies, or your emotions. Because that's what all of us have already done. So, you all have to have two meals. They're only going to give you one apiece, mainly because...
That's all you got.
Because I sent out Bill for the candy, which I thought he would bring more, but... But you have to have at least two pieces of candy. Okay? So, Cindy, go ahead and see who wants to. Just raise your hand, and Cindy will give you Reese's. Who wants to give their thought for one meal?
Start.
You can pick the same if you want. It's up to you what you want to eat. Remember, you've got to have two meals. So, Alex, why don't you take the payday? See how many people want to give her your body for a meal.
I'm the payday for the peanuts. I'm not doing
my body. Which, again, is that's the better sugar. Right? No, because it has peanuts. Because it has protein.
So that's this.
That's it? You guys have to have two meals. Okay, so Anna is selling Kitty Kitty Kit Kats. And that is selling your emotions. So make sure you end up with two pieces of candy.
This? It's making me sick.
If you don't have two meals yet, there are still two things here. There are Hershey bars, and there are, I don't even know what these are. Take five.
Oh,
I don't know what those are. You can choose one day of thought, one day of body, and one day of emotions to give for one of these. So, who does not have two candy bars? Everybody. Anybody want to trade?
One day each of those, or for one day all three of those?
You give one day of thought, one day for your body, one day of emotions for one.
Oh, how's that different? So we we'll end up with three.
Because you're doing your body.
Yeah. No, you have to
give up three things for one candy bar.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. Everybody settled? Everybody good? So here is the Reese's restaurant that some of you will be visiting. And we have Payday Restaurant. Payday, your lucky day. Here. And we have the Kit Kat Restaurant. So in this town, that's what's happening. And, of course, if you eat these, what are you going to want the next day?
More.
Because that's what sugar does, right? So because sugar completely disorders your body's need for or desire for what is good for it, it actually wants more. So because you have been satisfying yourself with sugar, you're going to continue to want more. So you're going to continue to be going to these restaurants. The sad thing about this town is, although they have all these restaurants, there has always been a restaurant that served food for life. The restaurant's called Heaven Meets Earth. What is that supposed to symbolize, do you know? Where does Heaven Meet Earth?
Church.
Well, yes.
It's the bird.
Or at that point is the temple. Right? So the temple's always said that that's where heaven meets earth. So there's always been that. And that restaurant is the only restaurant that actually has a chef. You don't need chefs. That restaurant has a chef. The chef has always been around, and the chef has always been cooking good, nutritious food. Right?
Come on, go.
But because you started off with sugar, you don't want it. And the chef is frustrated that he is actually cooking all this good food.
Nobody eats it.
Everybody's eating sugar. And so he decides that maybe he should appoint a few people from out of town that could come in and be waiters, that they could actually serve people. Because in these places, the way you eat is, so do you remember the scene in A Christmas Story where Ralphie, no, not Ralphie, Ralphie's brother loves mashed potatoes?
Yeah.
How does he eat?
Like a pig.
Right? No hands, no tools, just as a pig. That's how you guys are eating your sugar. Which actually, if you know, if you've ever been into a place where your blood sugar has dropped, what do you feel?
Ravenous.
Oh. Ravenous, and that is exactly how you begin to eat, right? And in fact, I love the fact that in our culture, we have commercials about how you feel when that happens, right? What do they call it?
Hangry.
Hangry. You're hangry. So if you've seen the commercials, people are werewolves or whatever they are because they're hangry, because their blood sugar is dropped, which tells you that they have been eating refined sugar so that their body's blood sugar is going up and down. Unfortunately, this happens to me when I actually do eat sugar because I'm insulin resistant. So this happens. It has happened to me since I was a kid. So I know that feeling immediately. So in the restaurant where the chef is making actually healthy food, food for life, food that actually give you life, he's decided that he's going to bring in some waiters from the outside to serve you the food for life. And perhaps that will then get you into his restaurant because it's a big restaurant and nobody's coming in. And so he actually determines that he will choose a couple waiters. And so he chooses Michelle as a waiter. Well, you want to be a waiter? And Diane, you want to be a waiter? Okay. Put on your little wait staff aprons. And what the chef says is, now waiters, I'm going to give you food for life that I want you to serve to people. And I'm going to give you things for them to actually use as they eat this food so that they aren't eating it as pigs. They're not ravenous. They get to have these things once they start eating regular food because they won't have that hangry, right? Think about a whole town that's hangry.
That's awful.
I'm not liking this at all.
It's making me so uncomfortable. Yeah.
Chef says, so this is what I want you to serve. I want you to serve this. So what happens with those waiters? Let's think about a town that's hangry.
They're going to get treated horribly.
They're going to have to sell real hard.
Yeah. And they get, so I'm going to give this to the first waiter. And she's knows that she's supposed to serve that with the plate and napkins and knives and forks. And the first thing she's thinking of, what is that going to make me look like? Yeah. What have we been struggling with this whole time in Romans?
Shame.
My honor and my shame, right? So Michelle and Karen and Diane look at that and go,
yuck.
Everyone is going to hate me for this.
Ranch dressing.
There you go.
So pretty much, right? They say, well, you know what? How about if I just give them the plate and the napkins and the silverware, and I'm just going to go and get some more sugar.
Uh-oh.
And so, Michelle and Karen and Diane, come get some more sugar and start offering it on plates to people.
Any of them?
Take a whole bunch.
Girls. Want more?
You don't have to take it.
You don't have to.
So,
I have it.
So waiters.
I got some things.
Waiters, as you're serving that, and people are saying no. You're going,
sugar.
Oh, no, you need this.
Yeah.
You need this. Uh-huh. But you, when you give it to them, you also have to give them the plate and forks and knives.
Oh, okay.
There you go. Right? Because that's what you have to offer that's different. Right? Okay.
Yep.
So Janine now has a plate full. So Diane, you just have, if you, nobody wants it, you have to give it to somebody.
I hate that I want it.
Believe me, having all this candy here, all yesterday, really tough. So, all right, so now we still have a town that's hangry and waiters that have not fulfilled what they were called to do. Right? They gave the plate and napkins and forks and knives with the sugar that other people wanted in order to maintain their own honor, right? Mm-hmm. And their honor was maintained because they have the plates and napkins and knives and forks.
Got to get rid of a lot of thread.
Yes.
Mine's disappearing.
Now, the chef, what's he thinking? Well, I have to get rid of those waiters because
they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Not just that they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, this chef is really concerned about the health of his town. He cannot keep the wait staff that continues to give them the food that will not give them life and says, oh, our food is better because it's on a plate. So hand in your...
Sorry, everybody.
You're fired.
You're fired. Yeah, you're fired. You're done.
So the chef says, that means I'm going to need somebody who's not concerned about their honor and shame, who's not actually already been under the power of sugar, right? Because all of you are. So I'm going to need to send you somebody. And the only person as a chef that I know is my own family. Because I have not fed my own family sugar. And so, of course, he sends his son. Where is his son? Oh, there he is. And so his son comes to open up this restaurant. And his son says, come, everybody. Come. We have food for life. And all of you are hangry. And I want you to think about what would a hangry town do with somebody who's standing there and saying, I have food for life. You're eating the wrong foods. What would a hangry person do? Oh, would they say no thank you? Think about those commercials. What do hangry people do?
Turn into monsters.
Yeah. And so what do monsters do?
Destroy.
Okay, so throw your candy at them. Literally, throw your candy at this. Wow. Yes.
Wow.
And so, he sent the one from his family that didn't care about his honor and shame. And because of that, all of the food that wasn't for life, all of the food that actually is bringing these people to an early death, is actually piled on to the one who had no shame, no honor, no worry for honor. And so what he does then, this son of the chef, he spends the next 3 days picking up all of the food.
Some of the people kept their candy though.
Ooh.
Interesting,
huh?
Yeah.
He begins picking it all up for 3 days. And for 3 days, he takes that which is not good and does what needs to be done with it, putting it in the garbage, right? So he picks it all up. Is there any? Jenny, I'm worried about you. Have you saved any?
You want it all?
I want it all.
Okay.
Yeah, she wants it all.
So that
I want it all.
And he takes whatever has not been given out.
Gets rid of that.
That was already given. And what was supposed to be given in the future.
Looks like Jill's covered for Halloween.
And he puts that in the garbage can. But in reality, he was underneath it all, right? And so the chef said, all of that bad food is gone. I can now take my son out of that place and bring him up so that he can open up a restaurant so that all people will see that they can actually come into that restaurant. And that now this chef's son says, come here, anybody. You need nothing for the food I'm giving you if you will only allow me to feed you. So not only has he taken what was not good for you, now he wants to feed you. And so the only requirement he's saying is to come into his restaurant is, let me feed you.
But I'm still craving sugar.
Yep. And he says, can you trust me? Can you trust me to feed you? No longer eating with your mouths, with your hands, with your eyes, but letting me feed you. And so the question becomes, the question doesn't become this. It's a question, open your mouth. You need to eat it. Will you eat it? Lisa, will you eat it? This is what the chef's son says. You come. It doesn't cost you anything.
He doesn't have any more silverware and plates.
Except, and then he says, now that you've begun eating it, you're right, you still have these cravings, right? But the longer you let me feed you, the more the cravings are going to go away. And at some point, I'm going to give you those forks and knives and plates back again, and I'm going to actually put the food on the plate, and you're going to be able to be in community with people who are all eating healthy food, and then be able to invite others. Oh, let Jesus feed you because it's healed me. Look what it's done for me. That's the story that Paul's trying to tell in Romans 3. So, you want the carrot?
All that to continue eating healthy.
Well, thanks for all the props. Jeez.
That's a good illustration.
So as we look then into Romans 3, I want us to think about that, about truly what sugar does to us and how it makes us crave it more and more and more, because that's where Paul is going to go, telling us that's what sin does for us, being ruled by our form, but that he offers a way out, but it actually takes us to a place of complete vulnerability, complete reception. Mm-hmm. And so, and I think it's interesting because what was Cindy's first reaction? Okay, I'll receive it. But in reality, he says, I want to feed you because I'm feeding you of myself. I don't want you to take it because if you take it in your hands, you still get control, right? And you feed yourself. So hopefully that will give us a little bit clearer idea of what Paul's talking about when he uses all of these big theological words that we pretend we know, but I think is a little more abstract for us. So let's get into the text. So Paul has made a case in Romans 1 and 2 for the fact that we've all suppressed the truth. We've all exchanged the glory of representative rule. And he says that's manifested in obvious unrighteous lifestyles as he outlined in Romans 1. But even more so, it's manifested more commonly in judgment, by judgmental groups. By our identity with groups that say we're superior to other groups. That, again, is suppressing the truth, Paul says. And he says, no matter how you suppress the truth, whether it's by these obvious unrighteous acts and behaviors or by these superiority groups, these groups that say we're better than other groups, we know better, we live better, all are still going to be judged by God's impartial judgment. So that, the judgment is there so that it can be cut out, so that there's space for truth and glory. However, by the time we get to chapter 3, there's still this niggling suspicion amongst his readers that there should be some kind of exemption from judgment due to a status that God himself has given the Jewish people. And every once in a while I'm going to say, how does that parallel with us? Because we are not Jewish people, most of us except for Michelle. Why do we care about this? But it's the same thing as if to say, well, God, you made me this way, so why should you judge me if I follow what I am? That's the whole idea here. So even though he's talking about Jews here, he's still also talking to us as Gentiles who say, well, you made me this way. You made me with a proclivity to... I used to have a cousin who was just, every word out of her mouth was just a lie. Well, but that was how I was made. Or, I have a propensity for anger. Well, that's just how I'm made. Whatever it is the same footing as this, as Paul will introduce in chapter 3. So Paul is once again going to use his imaginary questioner, his Jewish legalist, remember, who is outside of the church, to get to the heart of the matter. And the matter is God's faithfulness, God's eternal faithfulness. Faithful once, faithful always. Why this is necessary is because it is God's faithfulness that is being displayed in the gospel. And if God's faithfulness is in question for the past, his faithfulness to the Jews, his faithfulness to his covenant in the past, then the question becomes, well, why should we trust his faithfulness in the present? So Paul will answer that by letting the Jewish non-believer actually ask questions about that, because the Jewish non-believer feels like God is being unfair. As we all have questioned at one point or another, Paul is going to actually allow this questioner to put forth his objections to impartiality, why there shouldn't be some exceptions, because he knows that that needs a hearing, but he also knows that he's going to explain how the gospel works. He's going to explain that so that the audience, his believing audience, will recognize that there are implications to receiving the gospel. This can be, sometimes I think we hear, I'm sure all of us have heard questions or similar questions that the Jewish man is going to ask. Questions like, well, how can God be loving if he allows unjust suffering? Or how can God, I can't believe in a God who lets bad things happen to good people. Right? Have you heard that? Mm-hmm. Always, right? And so what Paul wants to put forth is kind of showing that those kind of questions, while necessary to bring out, are based on a system of merit. And that's not how God works. God doesn't work on a system of merit. We'll talk about that in a second. But then as we go into chapter 3, and this is where I struggle too, the question might come for us is, well, why should we care so much whether the Jews think God is unfair or fair? Why should we care? Why do we care about the Jews receiving the Messiah and coming into the church any more than anybody else? The danger that Paul knew about in the Roman church as well as today of not caring about the Jewish people coming into the gospel message, being able to recognize the gospel, is that what happens is we'll tend to think about the church, having started accidentally in a Jewish world, is really a Gentile phenomenon. And the problem with that is, without the Jewish storyline, we won't recognize that salvation is a demonstration of God's faithfulness. Instead, we'll say that salvation is just a fix for sin, rather than part of a process of which God has been revealing himself to be trustworthy in relationship, which meets then humanity's biggest need, that of belonging in a secure attachment. So then it becomes a problem for us to say that the Christian faith is a relationship when all we talk about is Jesus dying for sin. We've missed the Jewish storyline that says salvation is much bigger than that, because it is about seeing God as trustworthy in a relationship. And when you present the gospel as Jesus died for your sin, there is no connection to relationship with God when you talk about it that way. Therefore,
for God so loved the world
that he gave his only son, right? Paul says we have got to have the Jewish storyline. We've got to care about the Jews coming in. And in caring about the Jews coming in, because they bring the fullness of the storyline, he hints at the fact that it also means we should be caring about everybody because they have something to contribute to the storyline of the gospel. But when we think about Christianity as a New Testament phenomenon only, forgetting about the Old Testament, forgetting about the Jewish line, forgetting about the Jewish people, we then lose the understanding of the word Messiah. In fact, we all use it incorrectly because we all say, we all use it as a proper name, right? We call Jesus, Jesus Christ. When in reality, we're using Messiah, the word Christ, as his name. It's not a name. It's a status. It's a position. We should be saying Jesus the Christ. Why have we lost that? Because we don't continue the storyline. A Jewish man would never call Jesus Christ. He would say Jesus the Christ. I wish I would have questioned Robin. Robin told me yesterday that she, the other day, passed a Jewish messianic synagogue. And it happened yesterday and the day before, happened to be Rosh Hashanah. She said, I'm going. So she went to this Jewish synagogue in Rosh Hashanah. And she said one of the most amazing things, she said it was the best service she's ever been to. Most diverse congregation she's ever been in. She said the amazing thing is, they never simply called God, God. Every time they gave him a title, God the King, God the Messiah, God this. And so when we lose that Jewish connection, we begin to think that Jesus' name is Jesus Christ, but it's Jesus the Christ. Why is that important? Because the Christ, the Messiah, tells us what he's to do, what he has come to do, what he has done. And the Jews would have known that Messiah came not just to take his people out of oppression, but to rule the entire world in a benevolent rule. So what have we lost? We've lost the idea that salvation is not just about taking us out of the oppression of sin, but also about moving history to the place where God is ruling over all of the world, where Messiah rules the world, and with his restored people, restoring all of creation. So a New Testament gospel truncates salvation, and it ends with me, right? I'm saved. Huh, good. Rather than continuing the story to say, there's more to it. I now have a renewed purpose, and now I'm to live into that purpose. And so what would happen if we dismissed the Jewish element within the church? The Jesus movement would actually turn into this private spirituality, not concerned with the kingdom of God so much on earth, but more concerned with cultivating my own spiritual interior. And it would no longer be a movement that was based on God's process toward restoration of all creation. It would become a religion that looked, that felt it was different from the Jewish religion. Which is exactly what's happened, right? All of those. And so Paul is going to make a case throughout Romans. We cannot exist as an accurate reflection of the gospel people if we're divided. The Jews are important, as are all of the other people that are invited in. The chef's son invites everybody in, not just certain people who have plates and forks and knives. So, if that's true, then now we can begin to understand why he opens up chapter 3 with the Jewish legalist questioning impartial judgment. So we get to 1 through 8. So here the questioner is going to use the logic of merit, which is exactly how all of us look at things, where God is viewed as a banker that has a debit column and a credit column. So that questions of fairness evolve according to a merit system, which is how we always look at fair, right? Mm-hmm. It's fair if this equals this. It's fair. But it's not fair if those columns don't add up. That's where we get people asking, well, I can't believe in a God who allows these kinds of things. They're all working on a merit system. Or we could even ask, as some have asked through chapter 3, is, well, wait a second. If we're in a town of, we've been raised on sugar, and we can't get out of it, that sugar keeps on, why should I be judged for continuing to eat sugar? Like, I was born into this environment. Right? Fair question. But again, it is this system of merit. It's not fair, God, which is actually what the Jewish questioner is going to say. It's not fair. But what Paul will begin to show is, well, God doesn't work on a system of merit. God works on a system of love. In fact, he's not a banker. He's a father. And so a father will often look like he's not fair, right? Mm-hmm. It's not fair. Why are you grounding me if all I did was this one little thing? My little sins aren't so bad that I should be punished for them. But a father knows that judgment is actually good, right? So it's this idea of, we go all the way back to Job, right? It's not a system of merit that God works on. It's a system of love, being a father who wants the best for his children. So the objections to impartial judgment, he has four. The first is, is there no benefit for being a Jew? You've made me a Jew. Why don't I have any benefit for that? The questioner says, if circumcision doesn't matter, the marking out of a people for God's purpose, why does God bother creating a people for himself? Doesn't make any sense. We really have no purpose if circumcision isn't any benefit. And Paul says, no, wait. Circumcision is a benefit. Being a people of God is benefit. But the benefit is that you were entrusted with the oracles of God. You've been appointed waiters to bring good food to people. You haven't appointed to be people who don't get judged. You get appointed to bring good food to people. So oracles means his words of life, his words of flourishing. When God created the people, when he chose these waiters, he actually was showing his continual commitment to work with humanity, even a humanity who was stiff-necked. look, I'm going to choose these people, and they're actually not going to be great people. They're also going to be people who are hangry, who are actually full of sugar, which shows that I still have a commitment to people, even in their turning away from me. So the benefit of being Jewish, the benefit of having been chosen as a waiter, is that you have an undeserved privileged position. It's just like some people get appointed to be ambassadors for the United States. But in their being appointed ambassadors, if they commit a crime, the law doesn't say, well, you know what, you're an ambassador. So don't worry about it. No problem. They actually get convicted just as anyone else. And that's what Paul says to his Jewish. Yes, you do have a benefit. You got the benefit of being the privileged waiter, of being the privileged people who were to bring the good food to the rest of the world. You're rejecting your position by switching it up a bit. You gave them the law, the forks, the knives, the plates. But you switched the food. You still let them eat sugar. So you get judged too. The position was your privilege, not being judged. Second question. Do unfaithful Jews then, because my three waiters here were unfaithful in their function, right? Do they then show that God is unfaithful? That the chef who gave them that job didn't keep them faithful? Does that mean he's unfaithful? When the Jews rejected their privileged position, when they rejected the fullness of the blessing found in the Messiah, they failed to receive, maintain, and expand the blessing, which was in the gospel. They also received God's judgment. When he rejects them as messengers, as waiters, then hasn't God broken covenant with them? Didn't he promise to use Israel to be the messengers, to be the waiters? No, Paul says. No, he wasn't unjust. He wasn't unfaithful. Jews' primary function was to carry the gospel. Their rejection of the gospel is justifiably condemned. God's oracles still remain true. The good food that's sitting here is still there. That still remains true, and it needs to still be carried on. The fact that they chose not to carry that to the rest of the people needs to be judged because they're still giving out sugar. It's what they're still giving is not going to be life. And yet, even though they mishandle it, they mishandled their function, Israel is still going to be giving out the good food because God is true to his promises. Israel was chosen, had assigned function, pass on the good food. Israel was unfaithful to that function, rejecting the oracle that Jesus is the Messiah, that Jesus is actually the food. But because God remains faithful to his promise of extending the blessing, giving the blessing to the Jews, and then extending it, he actually is going to have to show his faithfulness to the world and his faithfulness to Israel. So he's going to have to find a faithful Israel. Somebody within that Israel group has got to stand up as faithful. But Paul says, everybody is a liar. Everybody lies. Everybody suppresses the truth. None then are able to carry the good news, the good food, the truth of who God is, the blessings, because all suppress the truth, all exchange the glory. Yet the truth of God needs to be demonstrated. It seems like he's in a place where things can't really go forward. His truth has to be demonstrated then by one who's not a liar, by one who's not been under the power of sugar, who does not suppress the truth or exchange his role, and also by one who is of Israel. It's got to be both. God is not going to let his plan for blessing the world We're reestablishing a flourishing environment. He's not going to let that fail just because Israel hasn't fulfilled their function. Thus, the gospel, Jesus as the representative of Israel, and Israel as the representative of the world, vindicates God in his faithfulness to his promise to Israel and in his faithfulness to his promise to the world. Both his words and his judgments are valid, Paul says. So, is God wrong to then inflict wrath on unrighteousness when unrighteousness actually reveals God's righteousness? Let me put it in the vernacular. This is a kid's saying. If my running into the street allows my mom to show me how much she loves me by putting herself in harm's way to save me, isn't she wrong to be angry at me? As ridiculous as that sounds, that's exactly what the question asks. Well, wait. Me running in the street allows mom to show me how much she loves me. Which is what he's saying. Which is what all the questioners who say, well, wait, why should God punish me for this if God is righteous, he gets to be shown as righteous by saving me and not punishing me and not judging me. When it's put to, like somebody else says that, we go, oh, that's so ridiculous. And yet, we do it all the time. Paul actually wants his audience to go, that is ridiculous. Because we're to say that to ourselves. That is ridiculous. To think that God should not judge us when we are unrighteous, when we pull and suppress the truth.
But I told you not to run into the street.
Yes, Paul says. I told you. God is, because for your good.
Yes.
Right? So, Paul then says, but I'm speaking in human terms. When he says this, he's apologizing. And he's apologizing because what he has just done is come very close to blaspheming God. Because he's basically saying, he's allowing his imaginary questioner, which is Paul's words, to say, isn't God unjust? And that is blasphemy. And so that's why Paul says, I'm speaking in human terms. And he'll say it once more. Paul says, no, of course God is not unjust. Because something that both Christians and Jews would have assented to is that God is a righteous judge. Right? We saw this in Job. God is a righteous judge. God's law embodies a righteous way for the world to live. They would have assented to this. The Jewish questioner would have assented to this. Therefore, what Paul is saying is, so your question is contradictory. You say you believe God is a righteous judge. The law is good. But then you say, my disobedience could be useful to God. So he's not really being fair to me. Because I'm really giving him a gift. Contradictory, right? What Paul is trying to say is human reasoning, worldly reasoning, this idea of a merit system reasoning, can't negate divine authority. No matter what the kid says, well, look, you got to show how much you loved me by running in the street and risking your life. That isn't reality. God isn't wrong to judge unrighteousness, no matter where it is found. If he only judged outside of his people that he chose. If I said to Michelle and to Karen and Diane, you know what, that's okay that you served everybody sugar. I'm gonna let that go. You can keep your candy bars. What does that say then to the rest of the world when I say all your candy is wrong?
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's what Paul is saying. Hypocrisy. That can't possibly be God. Because God is not hypocritical. God actually does what he says he will do. Mm-hmm. He is fair. In fact, the Bible will, and I love how the Bible does this, he will gradually show over and over again, but bigger and bigger, God is not fair. God is more than fair. He goes beyond fairness. I'm glad he's not fair. Because if he's fair, There's no offer of a free food dinner. There's no offer for me ever to get healthy if he's fair. No, Paul says, he's not unjust. He is more than fair. And so the last question is, if God's glory benefits from our lies, suppressing the truth, should we be judged as sinners? Now, you need to understand that for the Jewish people and for God-fearers, they would have understood that the category of sinners is actually a label. They would have agreed, yes, all of us can sin. Even devoted God-fearers can do actions of sin. But our status is not one of sinner. So when he calls him sinners, that's a status. That is a, this is who you are. The lie that the questioner is talking about, if our lies are suppressing the truth, benefits God's glory. Well, what's the lie? That God is not God, right? That he's not, that his order isn't good. That I'm not appointed to be his representative. In this idea that Jews think that they can sin but are not sinners, they think that only radically sinful people are sinners. Think about in Luke when he portrays a Pharisee praying. What does the Pharisee pray?
Thank
you, God, that I am not a sinner like that person over there.
We do that all the time.
Absolutely. Which is exactly what Paul's been saying over and over again, right? You keep on putting yourself up as if you're not a sinner. And Paul's trying to say, no, even you God-fearing Jews, God-fearers, Gentiles who came through the synagogue, even you are sinners. The issue then, lying for good reasons, which we also all do, right? Well, it's a white lie. It's a little lie. It helps somebody. It's helpful if I don't tell the truth here because I don't want to hurt someone. Right? That's all, we always say that. Again, we're always basing it on this merit system that we make up. The Jewish man is saying, look, the maintenance of Jewish superiority is actually the epitome of how Jews glorify God. Letting the world know that we are the chosen people is how we glorify God. That's what he's saying, right? Which is exactly what Christians do, right? We bring ourselves up and say we are the epitome of showing that God is the authority. When actually, when we do that, any act of superiority is always diminishing who God is. It's also how Rome worked. It's also how the United States works. The most brutal and exploitive policies were used to advance the glory of Rome. Can you think of any exploitive policies that the United States uses to advance their own glory?
Almost everybody in government.
Our policies, right? There's lots of policies. I'll use an old one. This is political, so it can get a little hairy here. We said that it was a good thing to waterboard people, right? You know what waterboarding is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good thing to torture people because these are people who fought against our country. Mm-hmm. And our country stands for freedom of people.
Right.
Right? Okay, exactly. So that's what Paul is saying here. Lying for good reason, so torturing somebody for good reason. I mean, think about that. That's what Paul's saying is you can't do that. Let's do bad things so that good might come. Mm-hmm. The problem is this is what they had actually applied to Paul when Paul was preaching the gospel of grace instead of law. Well, you're telling everybody that they should do bad things so that good can come, so that they can be saved, not by doing good things, but by doing bad things. By Paul exposing this law-abiding Jewish man, this teacher of the law, as reacting to God's righteousness found in the cross, found in the resurrection, that he can participate in the same kind of lies is to show that everyone are sinners. And so that's when you threw the candy, right, at him, It is to say, it is to use that same thing, that reaction against someone who says, I have life. What you have is not life. And your reaction as someone who's hangry, someone who's under the power of sin, is to kill him, right? You can't say that about my lifestyle. You can't say that about how I live. I don't want you to say that about how you live, about how I live. And so, what Paul does with these four questions from the Jewish man is to reveal that even the most pious person is a sinner. And so he goes now into verses 9 through 20. And I'm sorry, we don't have time to read the verses. But 9 through 20, I hope that you took the time in the workbook to actually read all these Psalms. To me, that was, I loved it. I loved seeing what Paul was doing here. What he's saying with all of these Psalms, and you know all of these, this is a combination of several Psalms. Of like what, five different Psalms. Some, there's some Isaiah, some part in there too. He's basically saying both Jews and Gentiles are under sin. I hope what you saw in the Psalms, if you did all of them, is you saw that all of us are desperate. Like, oh, we hate this oppression in the world. We hate this wickedness in the world. This is horrible. And every time we said that, what we're supposed to see is, oh, I perpetrate that. All of this wickedness I hate, it's also coming from me. That's what you should have seen out of those Psalms. So even Jews, despite their advantage of being entrusted with the blessing, they too are ruled by the power of sin. That was the whole point of all of those Psalms. They know that they can't save themselves, right? That they are under a very severe power that they can't get out of. It's ruling over them the same way it rules over every other pagan that they thought maybe Romans 1 was talking about. So this is to make sure that everyone knows, yes, you've exchanged the glory, and yes, you are a sinner, and yes, you are under judgment. Paul says that Scripture attests to universal sin. It says that the wicked atmosphere that we are in, this sugar town, that's been perpetuated by us all. We're all involved in that. So secretly, even though Cindy and Alex and Anna were the proprietors of the sugar restaurants, you all were actually behind the scenes perpetuating, saying, hey, Karen and Pat and Carolyn, come on with me. Reese's is having a sale today. Yeah. Right? You're all perpetuating the same thing. You're all bringing us down the whole world, all of humanity down the path of sugar addiction. So he says the scope, and he goes through it. And I love the way he puts together these Psalms. He uses an inclusio. Remember what an inclusio is? The beginning and the end of a section are the same, right? The beginning and end of the section is not even one. To tell us, that's what he really wants you to say, no, from this, is not even one. There's not even a single solitary person that is righteous, that has a right standing before God in the covenant relationship. There's no one who understands. In other words, there's no one who has received the wisdom from God. There is none who seeks God. All of us together, I love that he uses this psalm, all of us together have become useless. Useless. Because we sold our function, we sold our usefulness, and now we have this function that only serves us. So we are useless, all of us together. None who does good. And now that we keep on remembering what good means, to fulfill the function so that environment that God has ordered is flourishing, we understand none of us does good. The list that he has here of all these scriptures, this first section, is apparent that when Paul talks about sin, it's more than just a transgression of the law. When Paul talks about sin, it's more than not eating with forks and knives on a plate in our little story. It is the rejection of our created purpose. It is the rejection of our function. So scripture attests to the scope of sin, that we've all rejected our created purpose, but also it attests to the effect of sin. All the things we see as wicked in the world, all the evil, are merely naturally multiplied manifestations of suppressing the truth, of rejecting our glory. So when we look out in the world and say, those people are evil, all that is a multiplication of suppressing the truth, which every one of us is involved in. Which shows us, again, Paul's collapsing this hierarchy that we set, right? And we do it. I don't care who you are. You have a hierarchy when it comes to looking at people. Some people are just not as valuable as you are because we label them as evil, right? And Paul is saying here is, that's just two times suppressing the truth rather than one time like you. You suppress it three times a day. That person suppresses it four times a day. How is that any different? You're still suppressing the truth. So he says, the problem with suppressing the truth is that it multiplies. The lies spread. And this is where he starts with their tongues, their throats are an open grave. Their tongues, they keep deceiving. When he talks about their throat being an open grave was full of pollution, right? You died, and usually you died of some disease, and you have now diseased the area around, and open, it means that it can spread. It's going to spread. In other words, the lies that you tell, the suppressing of the truth that you tell about God not being God, is going to multiply. It's going to be infectious. That's your enticing, your approving lie in others. Tongues keep deceiving. One lie leads to another. And every one of us have experienced this, right? You've told one lie, and boy, now you're in trouble. Because now in order to not to expose it as a lie, what happens?
Tell another one.
And then another one, right? And Paul says, lies multiply. Lips have poison of asps. In other words, an asp's poison can kill someone. As can our tongue. James says this. And our mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Remember, to curse is to actually call damnation down on someone. So as much as we today particularly think very little of the words we use, cursing is always a calling of damnation down on a situation or a person. Which means, if you're calling damnation down on someone, what position are you putting yourself in? I'm God, and that person or that situation should be damned. Bitterness is actually to be dissatisfied with God, which means you're actually condemning yourself. So lies spread. And then he says, conflict, injustice grows. Feet swift to shed blood. We become quick to hurt each other. And what I wanted you to picture in that sugar town is all of these hangry people running around. And think about what if for the day all of the candy had been sold and you hadn't eaten dinner yet? As a hangry person, what would you be doing?
Looking for
stealing.
What else?
Yelling, screaming,
pushing people out of the way, right? There's going to be some kind of conflict because you want what you don't have and somebody else has it because you're hangry. I remember as a kid, my mom loved to go to outlet malls. Now, when I was a kid, outlet malls were actually outlet malls. Well, they actually weren't malls. They were just outlet stores. So there was Sears Outlet, which was in Midway Airport. In one of their hangar buildings. That's where the Sears outlet first began. And it was literally an outlet. There were just boxes of stuff. And I remember as a kid going there, and if they'd get a new shipment, what do you think that looked like?
Black Friday.
Oh my goodness. People just pulling through and get out of my way, get out of my way. That's mine, that's mine. Yeah. That's the picture that you should be getting as Paul is showing us this, is that's who we are. And sometimes we do it in ways that seem very acceptable. But you know that it's going to bubble over into places that it's not going to be acceptable. Every once in a while, you'll see on the news some, I just saw it this week, somebody got out of their car and just started, oh my goodness, what, did they have a bat?
Yeah.
What?
So somebody was driving and
cut him off
or something, and he had a bat, road rage. And I think it was women. The woman got out and took the bat from and started swinging at her. I mean, this was just, and it was all on tape. But that's, that is just an escalation of what's already there. It didn't happen because he got caught, she got cut off. That was just over the top, right? But that's what Paul is saying, is we're all there. Have you never, when you're driving, just got really mad at somebody? Maybe you didn't have a bat with you. And maybe you didn't stop. Maybe you honked, right? Or maybe you yelled. Or maybe you just called them a name. It's in all of us. So injustice grows. Our feet are swift to shed blood, quick to hurt others. Our ways cause destruction and misery. Life gets torn down, and they don't even recognize peace because they've never even seen it. There is no fear of God. What Paul is trying to say with all of these psalms is sin overpowers any ability we have to escape its rule. We cannot escape the rule of sin. And he says, by the way, this is not about them. This is about us. He wants us to make sure we understand this is about us. This is not about, oh, the world out there. They're just so evil. They're just so wicked. They just don't know what they're doing. It's about us. It's all of us. And then he says, we look to the law, or at least some would look to the law. And he says, but the law's purpose is actually not to deal with sin. The law was intended to be a way of life for redeemed and restored people. Think about when the law was given. God made a covenant with Abraham and said, I will be your God, and I will make sure that you keep the covenant. Did he give the law then?
No.
When did he give the law? At Moses, at the wedding ceremony. It's a wedding gift. Law is a wedding gift. For people who have actually been restored to a different status. But when we're not connected in relationship, when we aren't in that marriage, what it does is lets us know that we aren't in a marriage, that we are disconnected. Here's a wedding present, and I look at that wedding present going, well, that's not how I live. Yeah, because you're not connected. So what the law does then, when you're not connected, is that it shuts every evil, lying mouth. It says, since all persons are liars, every mouth of humanity must be shut in order to silence unrighteous words, in order to silence those lies that are being told, in order to suppress the truth. And the lies that are told also through your actions. Everyone then becomes accountable to the truth. Not their own systems of merit, whatever they decide, but to the truth. But what God says is, when my telos is completed, that chronic perversion of humanity's speaking will be at an end. And the speech that will rise up will be the speech of worship, because it will be truth. God is God. And all humanity will say, amen.
Jill, can you quickly, I'm sorry, can you explain
explain when the law came? Because I was thinking it was different.
The law came at Sinai.
Okay.
Right? That's when it came, which is the marriage ceremony. But the first covenant is the Abrahamic covenant.
Okay.
At Abraham. Yeah. So there's no law until Sinai.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Although he does say to Abraham, live blamelessly before me or something.
Yep,
like that.
But not in a law. And that's always the problem, is reading something from a different culture, right? Yeah. So law is actually, as the, when you look at, I could do a lesson on this. When you look at the law, it is actually written so that the people, when they read it, they understood, oh, this is a law, this is a covenant, this is a law that you have to abide by and that you agree. In Abraham didn't agree to it, anything, right? He agreed to nothing.
It was all one-sided.
Yeah. So, yes, walk before me, but I've told you I will make you walk before me. So, he says the law shuts every mouth, and it shows that the works of the law, now listen carefully here, it shows that the works of the law will not justify any flesh. This is difficult, because when he says the works of the law, that word law there is not capitalized. It's the works of any law you come up with, whether it be the law of Torah or the law of whatever law you've decided. In other words, whatever transactions you think life works on, there is no transaction that will actually justify you. There is no way that your merit sheets can balance. Jews thought that being circumcised justified them as exempt from judgment. Flesh always says, it evokes this idea of superiority. I'm superior because I go by my law. And whether you're going by the Jewish law, or maybe you're going by the law of what people say, well, I live by the law of love, which is a mockery of what God says is love. I only do what doesn't hurt others.
Yeah, right.
And what Paul has already established is that's all we do is hurt others by the choices we make. So when he says the works of the law will not justify any flesh, the law of Torah is included in here, but all law, no matter what way you decide is the way to get life, no matter what transaction, none of it is going to justify you. None of it is going to make you right in relationship with God. Right as according to the covenant relationship. There's no transaction that's going to give you a right status. No human system of competing for glory and honor. And it helps us then to recognize that we're all under the power of sin. It exposes our predicament that we're powerless. That's what it means when it says it gives us knowledge of sin. I can't be righteous by myself. Now listen, this is really important. I cannot be righteous by myself. Think about what righteousness means. Righteousness means a right standing in relationship. How can I possibly be standing in right relationship by myself? That's to, yes, it's to say, I am a wonderful wife when I don't have a husband. That's exactly, but that's what we do, right? We stamp our feet and I say, I can be righteous. And Paul says, you cannot. You're disconnected. You cannot stand in right relationship in the covenant, because the covenant is a relationship with God. And you don't have a relationship with God. You say, I want to be on my own, which is exactly what Adam and Eve did, right? They stomped their foot. I want to be on my own. But I don't want to lose that status of righteousness. I want to be a good wife without being married. And yes, when we put it that way, we go, well, that's ridiculous. And that's the problem with some of our theological terms, right? When we say righteous, how can I be righteous? What do we mean when we say that?
Good.
Righteous is faithful relationship as far as the covenant is concerned. The covenant of relationship with God. So, when I suppress the truth that God is my God, that God is connected to me as ruling king, as father king, I disconnected from the only source of my being able to be righteous, right standing. And when I exchanged my glory, I traded in my connection, the power of connection, the righteous standing, for a connection with myself. I only want to be connected to me, my form. So it is true that we are born into an environment, that all of you are born into Sugartown, that this environment is so full of sin that I didn't know any other way to live. Right? You were born into Sugartown, you didn't know that there was other food, or could you have even gotten it on your own? So it does seem like your choice to suppress the truth and exchange the glory seems a little forced. Like, did I really have a choice? If I was born into Sugartown, did I really have a choice about eating the celery and the kale when I was born into an environment that only fed me sugar? Do I really have a choice? Which is what people are going to ask, right? God's judgment, though, and this is where we really have to understand this. God's judgment, he said, is going to be through Christ. So that at the right time, when God publicly displays Christ as the offer of healthy food, the offer of restored truth and glory, it is on the basis of receiving that offer or rejecting that offer that either judgment comes or justification comes.
Does that mean, to use your illustration, where you actually offered us the food? Like,
yep.
I'm going to close my mouth.
Yep. So that all of, let me get through this and then we'll talk through that, what that looks like. The cross reveals that judgment will be death. Separation from righteousness, from a relationship with the source of life. Because life is connection with God. And that's another problem. We always define life differently, right? Oh, I get to define life however I want it. Well, the truth is, God was the creator of life, and God says, life is connection with me. That's what life is. The resurrection reveals that justification will be the declaration of a new life, a new status. And Scripture gives example after example of how our lie multiplies. And the prophets, as well as the law, will say, but God is your refuge. He's the one to whom you're meant to be connected. And you aren't. So hang on to your questions. We're still getting there. So when we get to verse 21, what Paul wants to say is the shameful cross actually reveals an impartial grace. So yes, God is impartial in judgment, which also balances out in his impartial grace. Righteousness, the status of being in right relationship, can only come in Jesus, as Jesus faithfully deals with sin, which is what happened, right? When you threw all of your hangry candy bars at him, he deals with sin, not by throwing it back at you. You take it, you deal with it, I'll deal with it, I'll pick it up. He's the only one who could have picked it up without, think about this. The waiters here couldn't serve this because they were still drawn to the candy, right? Still drawn to the honor, to the sugar. They couldn't carry the candy or even carry, be around the candy without wanting the candy. They couldn't carry this without it. So this idea that Christ says, all right, bring it all to me, send it to me, I'll show you what it does to you, but I can carry it and not be tempted to eat that sugar. I'm not tempted to eat it, so I can actually carry it to death, do what it needs to be done, where God will judge sin. The lies and the rejection will be ripped of their power because God, through Jesus, puts them in the garbage can where they belong. They are obstacles to God being God.
I'm just saying maybe that Christ was tempted as we are, but he did not
succumb.
He did not succumb.
Correct.
So it wasn't
correct
that he could not be tempted.
You're right.
That he did not
succumb. Correct.
He did not succumb to the temptation.
That's right. And that's what we see on the cross, right?
Right.
Because he's able to actually overpower sin. Paul says this is witnessed by the law and the prophets. So the law and prophets are there to witness. And in Jewish law courts, you had to have at least two witnesses to say that something was true, which is what the law and the prophets do. They're the witnesses to say, here's the truth. The law says life is connection with God, and you can't live connected on your own. The prophets say God is coming to intervene in the midst of your powerlessness and save you from being disconnected. He will intervene at the right time with the right ruler. That's what the prophets have always said. So that righteousness comes as Jesus deals with sin from the outside. In other words, from a place of not succumbing to sin. So here we have, I want to look at verse 22 for a second. Somebody read just verse 22.
Even the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all those who believe, for there is no distinction.
So that faith in Jesus Christ, that's one of those genitive cases. And this is controversial because the genitive case can either be faith in Christ or Christ's faithfulness. So it's faith that either belongs to Christ or faith that is put in Christ. It's not clear in the Greek because that's what genitives are. And so theologians go one way or the other. And I would say because of the way Paul writes, I think it's both. So if it's the faithfulness of Jesus, which would be called subjunctive genitive, I know you could care less. If it's the faithfulness of Jesus, then it talks about Jesus being faithful to his function as the waiter, right? As the new waiter who can actually bring the good food. Because he is one that is not under the power of sin. He never suppressed the truth of God's sovereignty. And he is one who has power because he has received the power he's given rather than rejecting it. He's never disconnected. He's never tried to attain right standing on his own. Which, when you know that and you go back and read the Gospels, you will understand so much of what Jesus is doing there, is staying connected. That's the subjunctive genitive. Through Jesus' faithfulness to the function he was given, we also receive it by, receive it by receiving his faithful life, which is faith in Jesus. That would be the objective genitive. So it's both. Because of Jesus' faithfulness to his function, I can now receive his faithfulness. Not my faithfulness, but receive his faithfulness, which is offered to any without partiality. That's why the temple restaurant got opened up, right? So justification then comes in Jesus. What is justification? Justification is the declaration of a new status, which was meant for all humanity. The status is the status of Christ resurrected. In other words, the status of a truth teller. Somebody who tells the truth about God and takes on the representative rule. But it's status, not character. Why a new status? Because all have sinned and all have fallen short of the glory, which means we're not able to fulfill our created function with the status of sinner because we've suppressed the truth and exchanged our glory. So we all need a new status, a new right standing as far as the legal covenant is concerned. If I'm to be truly a partner of God, which I was created to be, and help restore the rest of creation with God, I have to actually have been declared with a new status. How does that happen? What makes justification possible? It's a gift of redemption. So, of course, a gift is undeserved. Even this word gift, we have so skewed the idea of gift. And we've talked about this many times, but I still get so frustrated about... I'm not going to get in my soapbox here. But we have Christmas lists and wedding registries and all these things that say, this is what I want, this is what I want you to give me. That's not a gift. A gift is, I want to give you what I know will be good for you because I've been married and this is what you'll need. I want to give you this gift because I think it will delight you. God gives us a gift. Not one that we demanded, not one that we put on a list, right? Because our list said, I want to be independently righteous. I want to be a good wife without having to deal with a husband. That's what we said. And so God gives us a gift that he says we need and will be good for it and will give us life. And he gives it to us impartially through his impartial grace, balancing his impartial judgment. There is no unfairness in God. He gives out more than we deserve and more than we want. Redemption, then, is to be released. And that word was always used to as the release from either a prisoner of war or a slave. So redemption, as the first readers would read this, would first of all recall the Exodus, right? Because that was their slavery, and that's what they rehearse every year. So redemption is the new Exodus. The original Exodus was a picture of what the Messiah, Christ, would do. Thus, we are released from the power of sin. By dealing with sin, Jesus stood in for Israel, was Israel. Israel had been called to deal with sin. Israel had been called to say, this isn't good food, this is the good food of life. Jesus did that. He was the faithful Israelite who took upon himself the burden of saying, in front of the whole world, which is why it's public, this doesn't get you life, it gets you death. I will take that on, and I will give you life. So that justification comes in Jesus, righteousness comes in Jesus, and mercy comes in Jesus. 25 and 26. How? This is interesting. In God's past forbearance, he says, sins had not been dealt with as they deserved. So for a long time, up until the Christ event, God had not punished, judged the sins as they deserved. Now, was there wrath here and there? Yes, he put us under the power of sin because it's what we asked for. But the final judgment was not given. He was waiting, it says. He was piling it up. He was piling it up, waiting for the right time. Other scripture says, for the consummation of the ages, for the time when the age of sin would come together with the age of grace. When that time came, then he would deal with all of sin in one place. So that all of us would have an alternative choice. So this answers the idea, well, wait, I was born into a sugar town. How did I really have a choice? This is why he waits until one time to bring it all there and says, here's what sugar's going to do for you, but here's what I have for you. You now have a choice once again to choose. Do you want the function I have for you? Do you want to cling to your independence instead? Do you want the mercy I have for you, or do you want your independence? The interesting thing when he says this is Jews were very used to this because, as next Wednesday we'll remind all the Jews again, on the Day of Atonement, Jews were to bring all the sins that they had not recognized from how long?
Forever?
For the last year. So the Jews knew about bringing all the sins into a pile and bringing them to God for judgment and then forgiveness. That was a normal thing in the Jewish. So they would think nothing of this. We tend to think about Jesus forgiving here and here and here and here, God forgiving, but God piles them all into one to put them at the place that can be disposed. So that what he does, and this is reviving these ideas of the sacrificial system, he says, Jesus then gets publicly displayed. What's the word it uses? What?
Propitiation.
Propitiation. Mm-hmm. How many of you just like use that word every day in your vocabulary?
Never.
And when I hear theologians try to speak about that, it's always laughable. Like they're trying to explain something that just makes no sense to me. It's the word for mercy seat. That's exactly the word for mercy seat. He says, Jesus Christ is the new mercy seat. It is the place where on the Day of Atonement, all of the sins of the year come together and are placed there, are sacrificed and placed there so that they can be dealt with. We've waited all year, the Jews say, and now we can finally bring them here. The mercy seat not only deals with the sins, all of the sins gathered together, but the mercy seat also covers and keeps intact three different things. What's inside of the Ark of the Covenant where the mercy seat sits on top of?
Manna and Aaron's rod and the law.
Okay. So the mercy seat not only deals with sin, but it also keeps intact the covenant of living as a beloved, faithful servant of God. The Ten Commandments. How to live as faithful kin and king. The mercy seat also keeps intact Aaron's rod, which is the choice of one who will be the priest, right? It keeps intact the one person who will be the priest to bring all. And it keeps intact the sustenance, the manna, the bread from heaven that will continue for God's people. All of that, Paul says, Christ is. Christ is the mercy seat, who is all of these things, who is the depository for all of your sins, because in his faithfulness to all of these, he is able to deal with sin as it is meant to be dealt with. And at his death, then he visibly reveals the mercy seat. How does he do that? Literally, how does he reveal the mercy seat?
You tear the curtain.
Yeah, the curtain gets torn right at his death. Revealing the mercy seat. Revealing, I am the place where all the sins get deposited and be dealt with by someone who isn't under the power of sin. And because of his faithfulness, it results in life, in his resurrection. And we have one more place then in his resurrection that the mercy seat is shown to be who Christ is. And that is, and this is hard to describe unless you've been to Jerusalem, but the tomb that Jesus laid is like a stone seat. And in one of the accounts of the Gospels, it says, they went in and they saw the tomb and two angels sitting on each side. What does that look like to you? Mercy seats. Where the two cherubims are sitting on the edge. Christ is the mercy seat, the place where all the sins are put into the garbage. He is the mercy seat where sin is actually dealt with. And he is the place of judgment. Remember, Romans 2 said, God has one standard by which to judge, and that is Jesus Christ. And so that when we say, but I don't have a choice not to sin, everyone now has a choice in Christ. That's why he gathered up all the sins and put him at this place. To receive through faith the act of redemption, of freedom, that was made through Jesus becoming the mercy seat, the place where the sins were deposited and the power of sin destroyed under his greater power. We receive then the gift of righteousness, right standing, by trusting that Jesus has been faithful as a human son of God, as our representative and on our behalf. Why is he displayed as the mercy seat? to demonstrate at the present time so that our new status, faithful relationship, is in effect now, recognizing that our present verdict anticipates the verdict at the end of time that will be issued on the last day. This is like the POWs of World War II. Many POWs that were in camps heard about the Nazis being defeated before their captors. If you've watched enough World War II story, you've seen this. And so the POWs know, oh, we're no longer captives. Now, it doesn't look like that because the captors don't know that, but they know it. And how does that change? I'm trying to think. There was a movie that had this, depicted this beautifully, that all of a sudden, the captors, who are emaciated, who are those people in that thing, all of a sudden they're like, I'm emaciated still, but I'm free. I am actually no longer under these captors. And the captors didn't know it yet, but eventually they would, right? The declaration of righteousness, of justification, we've been justified, does not give us a new moral character. Just like the POWs, when they found out, oh, they're no longer captives, the realization was there, but the reality wasn't worked out yet. It would be worked out, right, in days to come. They were still emaciated, but it would be worked out when they returned to eating good foods, when they return to good beds, when they return to a purposeful life, gradually, over time. But their status was changed immediately. You are no longer captives. The war is over. And now we'll live into that. Which is what Paul is saying here is, you've been given a new status, and for the rest of Romans, he's going to be saying, so can we live into that? Can we now begin to eat the food of health and live into the status of truth tellers, of representative rulers? So that at the present time, so we recognize that our status has changed, God's righteousness, God's faithfulness as the just one who is not going to allow man's sin to be the last word. He will rid the world of sin by first passing judgment. I'm declaring sin is done. And the justifier of the ones who will trust Jesus' faithfulness, reconciling and rescuing the intended functional rule of all who want it impartially, thus showing that God has an utter commitment to putting all things right, because in putting humanity right, they in turn can put creation right. Faith in Jesus, then, as Paul's talking about it, doesn't merely mean to assent to the fact that he made a way for our release and a new status, but receiving his faithful life as our life. That's that eating part where Cindy had to eat the celery. What he's giving, you have to eat it. It's not like, well, thank you, because if I would have let Cindy put it in her hands, and I've seen this happen before, Cindy would, well, thank you, but she's not going to eat it now, mm-hmm. right? She's going to put it away, decide to do with it what, right? She still has control. When it talks about in Jesus, and notice all of these are in Jesus, in Jesus, in Jesus, it is to receive his life as our life so that we're intimately connected, so that we are his bride. Because only as his bride can we actually be in right relationship. Can we be righteous with that connection? And if God justifies people in the present, ahead of the final judgment, faith has to be a characteristic of those that are justified, right? We've got to have faith continuing on. And so that leads to the very last section of Paul, chapter 3, is that since we have come, and this idea of in Jesus as it goes, it is an explanation of the gospel, the righteousness of God revealed from faith, God's faithfulness, to faith, Jesus' faithfulness, by faith, our faithfulness to take his life as ours. So that we now enter a world of grace. And here's the thing about the world of grace. The world of grace actually enters into the world of shame. So that it isn't the end of the world of shame and the beginning of the world of grace. It is the world of grace entering into the world of shame to transform it, which is the evidence that new creation has already begun. For us to proclaim a gospel of new creation coming is to lie, is to say that Jesus did not start new creation already in us, so that we live by a new honor system, a new honor system that doesn't include boasting, because we recognize there's nothing that I could have done that I would have deserved to live with God again, that I would have deserved to be able to go into that restaurant and eat from his hand. I live in a new family, both Jews and Gentiles, both liberals and conservatives, both Catholics and Orthodox and evangelicals are brought to equality in and through the cross. All revealed as sinners, all given access to grace of a new restored status. And I live in a new world that exists in the midst of this old world. Because we have been accepted without merit or cause, we too were involved in throwing that candy at him so that he actually fell into the garbage can himself, squished by all of that. We participated in that by our suppressing of the truth. If we were accepted, it necessarily means that we offer the invitation to others. So that as we sit in this restaurant that's open, we are going, hey guys, it literally is free. It really will give you life. You're welcome to come in. We aren't the only ones invited in here. God's righteousness begins to expand as the church, who has received that new status, actually begins to live out that new status. Summary, quickly. Our predicament is powerlessness due to sin ruling over us. We can't be in right relationship on our own. Sin is overpowering us, and it's making us connected only to ourselves. We can't get out from under the power of sin on our own. Remember, the implications of God's righteousness being pardoned to us freely means we've received it freely. We haven't had to use the forks and knives to actually get it. In fact, Christ fed us. We didn't have to exchange our body or our mind or our will. To claim superiority, then, is to thwart the gospel and the goal of God's gospel, his purpose and goals. The only response is to maintain and expand the offer as impartially as I was given it. Father, there is nothing but silence that I can give you when we recognize the gift that we didn't deserve, the relationship status, that when we were your enemies, when we were disconnected and said, I don't need you, you said, you need me, and I'm going to give you myself. Father, I pray as we continue this week to look at the places where we do things for our own honor, may we recognize that that too is turning our back on the gift of redemption, of a new status. We are not sinners, but truth tellers. Father, I pray that this week we would examine our lives and be encouraged and motivated by your Spirit to live into the new status that you've given us through Christ our mercy seat. In Jesus' name, amen.